Thank you so much, Michael. And thank you to Judith and Catherine, who invited me and brought me into this lovely community. So I'm really excited to be here. My name is Matt. I'm going to be your racist teacher today. Just a little forewarning. I know that may shock a few people, but I believe I have to be the first one to say that I am a racist. And so I'll get more into that in a little bit, but I am your racist teacher today. So we'll be moving forward. But first, I want to open us with a song. So Tim, can you play that song for us?
Here it is. Sorry, it's just loading slowly today.
At the same time, all the corruption and justice, the same crimes, always a problem. If we do or don't fight and we die, we don't have the same right. What is a gun to a man that surrenders? What's it gonna take for someone to defend her? If we all agree that we're equal as people, then why can't we see what is evil?
Of minds, bodies, and human rights, stripped of bloodlines, whipped and confined. This is the American pride. It's justifying a genocide, romanticizing the theft and bloodshed that made America the land of the free. To take a black life, land of the free, to bring a gun to a peaceful fight for civil rights. You are desensitized to pulling triggers on innocent lives because that's how we got here in the first place. These wounds sink deeper than the bullet your entitled hands could ever reach. Generations and generations of pain, fear, and anxiety. Equality is walking without intuition, saying the protector and the killer is wearing the same uniform. The revolution is not televised. Media perception is forced down the throats of closed minds, so it's lies in the headlines and generations of supremacy resulting in your ignorant, privileged eyes. We breathe the same and we bleed the same, but still, we don't see the same. Be thankful we are God-fearing because we do not seek revenge. We seek justice. We are past fear. We are fed up eating your shit because you think your so-called black friend validates your wokeness and erases your racism. That kind of uncomfortable conversation is too hard for your trust fund pockets to swallow. To swallow the strange fruit hanging from my family tree because of your audacity to say all men are created equal in the eyes of God, but disparage a man based on the color of his skin. Do not say you do not see color. When you see us, we can't breathe.
And with that, good morning, everybody, and good afternoon to those coming to us from the coast on the other side of the nation that are in the afternoon already. I am coming to you from Chumash land. I'm originally from Ohlone land, the Ohlone peoples in Northern California. Today, I was asked to talk about behavior and culture. So that's what we're going to get into. We're going to talk about roots. I'm going to very few history facts, so don't feel like you need to memorize much. This will be a good one to take notes of, though, so it'll be kind of a very notey kind of talk. Then we'll be getting into some science, biology, and then some culture forming, and then healing, because really what I want you to walk away with today is the path of healing. I believe that is the spiritual work that we are called into. I believe anti-racism work is spiritual work, and so we are joining in with each other in that spiritual work. Before I get started, I would like to ask, I know Tim asked everybody to mute themselves, but can people unmute and tell me what their definitions of anti-racism are, or what their definition of racism is? We'll start there.
Entitlement.
Okay, good.
Not believing all are equal.
Believing that there's a hierarchy of races and that some races are superior to others. Again, that all are not equal.
A caste system.
A caste system. Ooh, somebody's been listening to some Isabella Wilkerson.
Power.
Power.
Silence.
Oppression.
Oppression.
Ignorance.
Ignorance.
Fear, and out of that fear, taking actions to actively suppress anybody that you view as other.
Wonderful.
Exploitation.
Exploitation. Great. These are all wonderful. Was there one more? I thought I heard somebody.
Imaginary boundaries, like made up.
Imaginary boundaries.
Yeah.
Okay. We can go into some sociological ideas with that one. Don't worry, we won't go too deep into sociological ideas today. Racism, by definition, you can write this down. It's the most basic scholarly one that I can come up with. It's not scholarly. Racism is a system of disadvantage based upon prejudice and power. A system of disadvantage based upon prejudice and power. That's the most simple one that I've come across. I've come across many, but that's the most simple one. And that's by Joe Feagin. He wrote the Why Do All the Black Kids Sit Together in the Cafeteria? Really phenomenal. Was like the original How to Be an Anti-Racist like 20 years ago. So explaining racism and race for those to understand kind of a public level. So
Matt, would you repeat that one more time?
Yes. Racism is a system of disadvantage based upon prejudice and power. And it's by Joe Feagin. He wrote the book, Why Do All the Black Kids Sit in the Cafeteria Together? And just so people know, I'm using a headphone here because I can't see my notes in front of me. And I have an audio system on my computer that reads to me in my earbuds. So I'm just going through things together and talking with you. So we're just in conversation with each other and with folks like Joe Feagin. And we'll be talking about the biology of racism and how it impacts our body today. And how that impacts our behavior. But before we get into that, I want to talk about racism, anti-racism now, as an act of humility. And when I say humility, I like to think of the Jesus saying I believe it's the Gospel of John, where he says, for thee to become lesser, for thy to become lesser, for thee to become greater. And I think that is the work of humility, where we are lessening ourselves and stepping into somebody else's shoes. And I hope as we see through the biological processing today and understand how culture gets shaped and what our work is in the work of anti-racism, I hope that becomes clear today. Anti-racism has many different facets, as we can, you know, you can talk policy, you can talk reparations, which is my favorite thing. We can talk, you know, police abolition. We can talk just education and training and JEDI, which is justice, equity, diversion, and inclusion training. You know, so there's ethnic studies, there's education, there's talking about biological differences. And so there's many different facets of anti-racism and what it looks like in our community. You know, you can go into media and movies. And so there's many different aspects in fashion. So that's just thinking all of the ways our culture is shaped. So just think of the ways our culture shapes race has a way in that. For those that want to dive a little bit more into, I know this is a spiritual community and many people here are from a Christian background. There, I've created a survey that I'll give you the link to later, but I just wanted to mention this as a way of engaging with faith in an anti-racism way, because our faith institutions have a big role to play in this, especially in America, because the first excuse for enslavement in America was that you were not Christian. It wasn't that you were African or Black, it was that you were not Christian. And the first excuse, and the excuse for, or reason for colonialism, for genocide, is that you were not Christian either. So that you were heathens and savages, infidels. That's the doctrine of discovery in the Romanus Pontifex of 1452, 1457, and 1493. And that's what gave way to our modern colonialism. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit too when we talk about policy. But I just want to give that little nudge out there. If you want to go take a fun little survey, it's a 50 question survey. There's a just kind of see where you're at, and it provides some readings that you could do afterwards to expand your knowledge in the areas that are still needed. So, but it's a Christian based survey, meaning how Christianity has played a role within racism in our country. There's one history fact that I want you to remember today, minus, you know, you don't need to remember the policy stuff that I'll mention later. Those will just be kind of more anecdotal. But there's one today, and it is called the Bacon's Rebellion. And it took place in 1675. And you may ask, like, why is this so important? Why, you know, this, how does this, this is what has shaped our culture when we're talking about whiteness and Blackness, particularly anti-Blackness. Bacon's Rebellion, the revolt, it was a revolt against the elite, against James Barclay, who later would have Jamestown named after him. And it was, Bacon's Rebellion was the first united effort, a mass united effort of hundreds of people, Black, African, enslaved, well, actually they weren't enslaved yet, but indentured servants, as they were called at that point. They united and went against the elite and were actually winning and doing quite well. In 1675 was the first time that Black and white were used as delineated language in any written history. 1675, that's why that is important. And this was created by the elite. And this is even poor, so at the same, at this time in history, or up in, to this time in history, Africans and poor white and could be the same indentured servants. So they were just considered indentured servants. Their servitude was longer, but they were the same. So this point of Bacon's Rebellion is when that separation took place. And enslavement was hereditary if you were Black. And so this is the time when language around anti-Blackness and what it meant to be Black starts to come into play and how it shapes our history. So just a very important historical date. That's the only one that I'll share today. I know we don't like to remember dates. It just kind of, I hear you. I'm a historian. I don't like them either. And so that's the only one we're going to move into. And then we're going to understand this original trauma, I guess, to us as a nation. Because what happened is white people were pinned against Black people. Poor white people were pinned against Black people. Poor white people were pinned against elite white people. And indigenous people were also pinned against poor whites and, well, eventually enslaved people, because they were seeking to take over land. And so the enslaved people were told to partake in the genocide and the colonialism to remove and to clear the land. So these are things that are taught to us. These are things that we're told by those in power. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about power today, but we'll also be talking, you'll be able to connect the dots, hopefully, by the end and see how prejudice had built. So I'm going to move quickly through the biological stuff because it'll be not as important for, it's more just kind of getting the scope and connecting the dots. So this information that I'm bringing to you today is from a person named Tocole Bio. He does integrative biology systems. And so he understands, you know, the biological systems and how we integrate culture in biology. And he goes around teaching about this. What we're going to do today is see how racism is tied into the body as like our body, an embodiment, what they call somatic. And it's very simple at its root because we are made of neurons. Our gut, our heart, our brain are made of neurons. And neurons create your experience of everything. They fire, there's synapses, there's things that go off in our brain because of an experience, because of a chemical trigger. So we're just very basic biology here. We're not, this isn't too important to remember. We're just going to move quickly through this. So there's a parasympathetic system and a sympathetic system. The sympathetic is the fight or flight response. The parasympathetic is the rest and rejuvenate. So when we get into sympathetic, that means we're in that fight, flight, or freeze place. That's triggering our brain to say, watch out. That's triggering our brain to say fear, or it's something that is said that we are not supposed to be a part of. That means we are in danger. The parasympathetic allows us to be at ease, kind of to process and to be aware, you know, that kind of mindfulness practice that a lot of us like to engage with. They say, is kind of a famous saying that says, when you're at rest, you can digest. And so think of para as breathing and thinking and process. So, and it becomes a heightened state when you're able to be there in a process and aware in a thinking place. So that the para is good, sympathetic is stress. Our reactions, our triggers to these create habits. Habits create routines and rituals, and habits get ingrained. So if we experience something that creates a trigger in us over and over and over again, we create a habit, a way of moving through the world, if you will, a way of saying, this is bad, I'm not going to go do this. This is just biological, simple processing. Like, we can go a lot deeper into this, but just trying to keep it 101 here. And so when we have a habit, we create a perception. And a perception creates a perspective. And so, and this is all just through a habit of like, oh, no, we can't do that. And a habit is built off of like a fear place of, and it could be social fear, it could be cultural fear, it could be an actual life or death fear, but that there's a habit that is being built of what is good and what is bad. And a habit, again, creates a perception, and then the perception creates a perspective. This is where we get into negative tropes. A trope is an idea, it's a myth, it's something that is constructed. So, and we'll talk about constructs in a little bit. So there's negative tropes that were set up in the way of anti-Blackness, in the way of enslavement to excuse the enslavement of humans. So, and that was created by elite. And it was perpetuated by the working class white folk that were wanting to maintain their hierarchy. And so the negative tropes, the negative perceptions, perspectives, constructs were put forward for a way of protecting, because that was a way of maintaining their the white parasympathetic state, the white awareness, the white gaze. So that was, because that was fearful to not, because then you would fear the violence or something bad would happen. Think of it as the inferior person is in stress and the superior person is at rest. This, the perceptions or perspectives shape our posture. And again, we're getting it back into the body now. You know, this is all in the body. And so our posture, the way, you know, maybe some people sit like this, some people sit like this, some people have a deep voice, some people, you know, feel like they can be loud, you know, so our posture, also the way that we engage with others, so how are we posturing, is the way that our biological processes teach us. Posturing is how we present ourselves, simply. It can be permanent or it could be temporary. It could, because it's based upon experience, trigger, your culture, your just where you're at, your triggers, your social like your social interactions, your relationships. The physical body is a body that is created out of habits and postures that maintain the habits that keep the body safe. This could be a social, financial, relational posturing. So these are ways that the body keeps itself safe and protects itself. The oppressed and the oppressor have postures that they maintain around each other to maintain their social positioning, to maintain their social fight or flight, their social good or bad. And this is something that we look at in constructs. And when we get into constructs, we're going to see that these particular perceptions and perspectives and posturings create policy. The policy is, I like to go back to a teacher. He says politic comes from the Latin word politicus. Politicus just means the shared arrangement of our common space. Again, the shared arrangement of our common space. And politicus is where we get our word politic or political or, you know, policy, P-O-L-I-C-Y. Policy is the written word that moves our political system. So when we understand the posturing that goes into place and we're understanding a system, remember racism is a system of disadvantage based upon prejudice and power. Policy is being created from this posture of dominance and superiority. This is the racist structure that is getting built. It didn't just come about at that 1675 mark. It was built over years and years and years. It was another 100 years before our country's constitution was written. So the societal construct is a system that is used to fortify power. We're kind of moving out of the prejudice. If you kind of notice, we're talking about power a lot now. The prejudice kind of comes from our fight or flight. It comes from what things are going to keep me safe. Now we're moving into the construct, and the construct is where power is held, and policy gets created from that power place. The construct is designed to serve a purpose. We can ask the question, well, what is that purpose, and get into big discussions about that. But the construct is not hard in stone, meaning that it's not this the way it is, because if it was rigid like that, it would break. So race as a construct moves. And that's why a lot of people refer to it as a virus or a disease. I like to think of it in a symptomatic way of abuse, though. Abuse moves and changes. So I like the more social psychology end of things. It can look very different than the original. So racism now looks very different than it did in 1675, but in many ways it is still the same. And we have to go back to that original wound to be able to see the root of our harm and the harm that happened to us. So the thing that we have done, but then also the thing that has been done to us. So when somebody is threatened, you trigger the sympathetic state. And if you have a position of power that is backed by policy, then you have the ability to oppress. At the same time, in our society, as we have evolved as a country, it has also been said that we have a negative trigger response, a negative fight or flight response to being called a racist. And this is why I started today saying that, hello, my name is Matt. I am your racist teacher today. Because I believe that we have to be the first ones to say that I am a racist. A lot of people say, okay, yeah, but if you're saying I'm a racist and that's a bad thing and that's your identity. Like, okay, I can get around that. So a lot of people like to say I still have racist tendencies. Same thing. You know, it's still your fight or flight responses. It's still who you are. I like to just say I am a racist because I still recognize I have a lot of tendencies that are ingrained in me through my fight or flight and my posturing in the ways that I move through the world. A lot of people talk about this around the conversation of implicit bias. And so there's this way of moving through the world that is protected by whiteness or the construct of what it means to hold on to power in our particularly racialized country. And to be racialized is a social thing because we are taught the habits. We are taught how to engage with race. A baby doesn't come out of the womb racist. So when we understand the system of racism, it's prejudice because you have to teach the baby, but then it's power that gets reinforced so that it can be maintained as a position of superiority. And that's where we get the term white supremacy. I like to talk about it as white supremacism because it is a system. It's not just white supremacist as we like to think of, you know, the very violent actors. It's white supremacism as a system. There's different pillars and logics to white supremacy. The thing about when we get called a racist, we get triggered now and we don't want to be identified as a racist. This is a trigger response. This is a fight or flight response. And it's a place where shame starts to come in. White supremacy is a shame-inducing system. So calling somebody a racist doesn't give them the chance to change because it triggers a fight or flight response. This is, I believe, saying that I am a racist is me doing my active work to fight against that shame. As Brene Brown says, when you speak truth to shame, shame ceases to have its power. And so that's what we're doing here. I'm dedicated to being a truth teller to myself, a truth teller to my community, a truth teller to the world, because I don't want shame to have its power anymore. All right. I feel like now's a point where I would like to encourage you to take a breath. We're going to be moving out of the biological. I hope that was not too sciencey. I'm not a science person, but I just found that really helpful for people to understand how it has moved through our bodies and connected with our world and constructs and just how we as our individual selves in our neurons engage with racism and the construct of race. So I'm going to take a deep breath because I feel it, and I'm not sure if you do too. So my goal today was that I want you to be able to see a healing path. That's why we're talking about shame. And that's why we're talking about the body. That's why Kendi's encouraging us to talk about policy. He believes that policy is the number one thing that we need to go after and change to have a more free and equitable nation. So he focuses a lot on policy. If you read his previous book, which I highly encourage, I think it's his better book, honestly, is Stamped from the Beginning. He just goes in on the policy that is rooted in this country, that you know, those policies of the political system. And it's very powerful. So the posture of our bodies, we carry that. We move through the world in a particular way. We, you know, it could be a superior, inferior, you know, just feeling less than, self-worth, you know, we get into all those things. And that's a posture that is shaped by shame or fear or an anger or hurt, a trauma. And we have to get into the root of that. We are healing people. And so we want to be moving in that healing path, not in the path of destruction or separation. So we're going to talk about culture making now. Because what happens in posturing is when you have more than one posture, more than one person, you start to create a culture. I'm going to take a drink real quick. You get a posture that is socially decided upon. You get 1, 2, 3, 4 people that think the same. And like, oh, okay, we can create a culture around this. And this is where you get terms like white supremacy culture. This is where you get ways of thinking of supremacy, like the supremacist. You get bands of people that protect one another for their own well-being, to protect their fight or flight responses. And this is the culture is informed by policy, but policy is also informed by culture. Because when we have cultural groups that come together, they have more power than just the individual power that comes from habit and posturing. And so the cultural groups that have these, like, okay, we're gonna band together and protect each other, they have more power. And that's what we do in organizing, we build power. We organize together around mutual interest. If our mutual interests are rooted in a fight or flight freeze response, that is to protect yourself in a racialized social model, then we get systems of supremacy and superiority. And that's what shapes culture. Culture is a way of moving through the world that is dictated and kind of unspoken. It's something that is just taught. And in policy, it's the written word. And in our society, the written word is worshipped. We don't really talk about oral traditions too much. It's not like, oh yeah, you know, the standing by your word is not too much. There's a contract for everything, you know? And so we don't trust oral histories. We don't trust music as a form of teaching. It's just something to consume. So we understand that there's oral traditions that have shaped culture as well too. So when we talk about culture, we don't want to be monolithic, meaning only talking about one way of viewing culture. That often gets done in our histories already when we think of things in a very Eurocentric way. And that leads to just, more superiority, as you guessed. So we have from these cultural ideas, these ways of protecting one another, lies. And lies in the ways of tropes, also, there's things that myths that we're made to believe, but lies that are also in the way of like flat out lies of just false information. But these lies are seen as truths to protect us. So, and if it's somebody's truth that protects them, it'd be very hard to change and call it a lie because it's a truth. It's what protects them. That's their human way of moving through the world. So we're going to talk about policy now because Kendi really encourages us to talk about policy. But we're going to understand policy as a I'm hoping we can understand as a cultural thing because we want to be healing people that are moving in a healing culture, building healing culture that are moving in the path of repair. So there's a few that I would like to point out. Well, there's many, many, but I will actually ask after sharing these if anybody has any other ones. So kind of be thinking of your own policies that have been shaped by, you know, this posturing and this way of moving through the world, the perceptions and habits that we've created. So these are what I call the white lies of our culture. And the first one that I want to bring up is something called the Marshall Trilogy. The Marshall Trilogy is a judicial decisions of the 1820s. So one was 1827 and 1829, and the last one was 1836 by John Marshall. He was a Supreme Court. And essentially what these three judicial decisions did was excused colonialism and used the doctrine of discovery as the foundational elements for every property ownership in our country. So if you go sign a deed to buy a house, you are signing upon this doctrine that John Marshall put in place for individuals to own land. So this is a cultural thing that says we have the ability to own land, that we are here to manifest our destiny. You see how the kind of cultural things are taking place, but it is rooted in this fear that we are going to get taken out by these quote unquote other people. And so this we have to own and possess because that is our way up and to protect ourselves so that the fear could be that the King of England, King George, was going to come take our land back. So we have to own as much as possible to gain power. And so we understand that the way of owning property is the way of maintaining power, because if we have power and wealth, then we have the ability to dictate and organize for political decisions. And that's the, like, property is like the main thing that our society is built around. We have a constitution based on property rights, not human rights. We have a constitution based on property rights. When you think of owning slaves, it's in our constitution, 3/5 of a slave. When you think of the right for search and seizure. It's because you are either seen as somebody that is owned or possessed, or you're seen as somebody that is free and has a sense of privilege to move through the world. So, and you can go through our Constitution and amendments in that way and see that. So another one is anti-miscegenation laws. And that simply means marriage laws. So how do we see that marriage laws of, this was even rooted before the Bacon's Rebellion, that African people were not allowed to sleep with white women, or white men were not allowed to sleep with African women. This was put in place as a law during that time and was continued, or it was made a rule and was continued and put into law as the colonies developed and was made a cultural practice through this rule. I guess you can call it a policy of the colonies, even though the colonies technically didn't have their own constitution or anything. But that shaped the culture and then created this divide that white men couldn't be with black women and black women couldn't be with white men. And this still stands in many, I believe there's still 10 states with anti-miscegenation laws. And then we connect this dot culturally, so this is a cultural thing now, of anti-miscegenation laws, anti-marriage laws, and what that means for LGBT folk and how marriage laws are decided in this idea of who gets to dictate what is the way marriage should take place. And we talk about this Christian supremacy of like, oh, Christian is the right way and this is what God says. So we're really kind of seeing how culture and particular, you know, especially Christianity still plays a role in how our policy and our way, our shared way of living in our common space together is arranged. We understand that the original Bacon's Rebellion separation, black and white, that was binary. It was done in a black and white way. But race as a construct, remember, it has evolved. You know, it develops. It's not just black and white. And we have our racial constructs. We have developed us into this new way of thinking about things through a critical lens brought forth by Richard Delgado and Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw with this idea of critical race theory, which then came about this idea of intersectionality. And this is because when we talk about race, we're also talking about sex. And when we're talking about race, we're also talking about class. And when we're talking about race, we're also talking about gender. When we're talking about race, we're talking about disability. And so all these things have intersectional components. And we have to have a critical lens to be able to see how these things are shaped through our culture. If you want to, there's many other policies that are in place that move through our culture that shape the way that we live with one another. I mean, for example, the one that I'll just name right now before I open it up to ask you what some are that you can think of. I'm thinking of Prop 13 in our California. It's particularly in California, but it comes out of the legacy of legalized segregation in our country that was after the Federal Housing Act, where there was different graded communities based upon race. There was a grade A, grade B, grade C, and grade D. And Prop 13 sought to maintain that the best it could. And so, and we're still living in that legacy of Prop 13 and trying to figure out how to have more equitable communities. So before we move on, we're gonna move on to the next part of like, what is the healing that we can have in this? And what is our responsibility in this? But before I do that, I wanna ask like, what policies or cultural things that are coming to mind for you?
Redlining.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I'm interested in the benefactor society that we have of people being generous to those in other categories, like our community benefits so much from the upper crust that can fund our arts and things like that, but it's an interesting cultural thing.
Absolutely. we can get into that in the group share out at the end. Absolutely. I'm gonna keep going. I just checked time and I'm pretty close to the end here. So I wanna finish up, but this conversation on policy is a really exciting one because we're starting to like connect the dots and see how our culture is shaped and how we're participating in the system of racism and how power affords us to move through that system. So we have these harms, we have these harmful ways of moving in our system. And what do we do? I started an organization called Courage, which is Christians United for Racial and Economic Justice. I'll share that link out at the end. And it is an organization moving Christians in the path of reparations. Simply put, it is the reparative action. So how do we move in the path of repair and healing? Reparations kind of has a dirty word in our world because it's really challenging power systems and money. But the path of reparations is rooted in a restorative justice model. And restorative justice asks the question, what is the greatest path of healing? And so we move in this greatest path of healing and we have to address the body. So for white folk, the question is, what is the body, what is the racism in the body that needs to be addressed? And the Resmaa Menakem talks about white supremacy as white body supremacy. And when we understand the healing path from the wounds of white supremacy, five basic phases that white people have to do. And I'm gonna run through them. So there's reckoning, re-education, demonumentalizing, undoing harmful policy, and I would add public accountability or truth-telling. So what is the truth about your apology? And I would add, this is all in transitional justice literature. This isn't just me making this up. There's one more after that I would add though, and that is healing the white body and to remove and do the healing work for the posture of the oppressor to be removed, because that is still in our bodies. And that is talking about and dealing with power. So when we're talking about policy, we have to undo the harmful policy, but we also have to recognize there's an issue. We have to re-educate. We have to take down the monuments that hold and protect ourselves. And then we have to speak our truth about the ways in which we have moved through the world and benefited by moving through the world under this racist system. And then how can we move in the path of healing? So setting the demands is not our responsibility. Going through the transformative process, calling out the harms, we're not here to name the harms experienced by BIPOC people, Black, Indigenous, people of color. We're here to make way for the greatest amount of truth to be told. And we do that by undoing the harmful policy, demonumentalizing, re-education, and reckoning. So that's what I want to leave you with. That's the hopeful path. That is the work of white folk. I want to break us out into our breakout groups and discuss some questions that I've put forth. And then we'll come back and, you know, have some share outs. And then I have some kind of final remaining things of things that I'm seeing in the future of work that white folks need to engage with. It's not anything that we're going to go in depth with. It's just a list that I'll put in the chat and you can kind of dwell on the questions there. Tim Burnett. So. Breakout to the breakout groups now, and we'll be back in a few.